Great. Will the marshal call us to order, please?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Werke, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are here for our third case on our oral calendar, which is A22-0955, Antonio Terrell Beasley, Petitioner Appellant versus State of Minnesota Respondent. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for Appellant, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. At the start of your principal arguments, would each of you please state your name and the party you represent for the record? We are on Zoom this morning, and we are making an audio recording for our audio recording only for our website. Counsel for Appellant, we are ready when you are to begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Bo McGraw, and I represent the appellant in these proceedings, Antonio Beasley. Your Honor, as I was preparing for this morning, I was struggling a bit with the timing and the way the district court concluded that the post-conviction petition was untimely. I want to walk through that and see what, in fact, I might be missing here. So what I understand is that Mr. Beasley was convicted, and he went ahead and he appealed to the Court of Appeals his conviction. He did not appeal the issue that's in the post-conviction petition, but he appealed other matters that were relevant to his appeal. That became final as it was on October 15, 2019, when he petitioned the Minnesota Supreme Court for review. They denied review. What I understand then is that he gets another 90 days where he could have appealed this matter, further appealed by filing a petition for cert with the United States Supreme Court. So if I do the math on that, if I take that October 15, 2019, I add that 90 days to it, that puts me at January 13, 2020. I understand that's the law. You get that 90 days. I'm referring to a couple of cases. Clayview United States of America, 537, U.S. 552. That's a 2003 case. I'm referring to another case that I think is instructive in this regard. It's O'Mara v. State, which its citation is 679 Northwest 2nd, 334. That's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2004. Both of those stand for the proposition that a case doesn't become completely final until we add those 90 days, allowing for a defendant to further appeal or seek certiorari from the United States Supreme Court. So if I do that math, then it becomes final on January 13 of 2020. So now if we look at the post-conviction statute, Minnesota Statute 590.01 sub 1 reads as follows. Petitioners must file post-conviction petitions within 2 years of their conviction or sentence, or their direct appeal's final disposition, whichever is later. In this case, the way I do that math, it would have required Mr. Beasley to file a post-conviction petition based upon ineffective assistance of counsel, consistent with Minnesota Statute 590, on or before January 13, 2022. That's 2 years after it became final. Mr. Beasley, in this case, brought these issues before the district court, alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, on January 11, 2022. His petition was denied without a hearing. The court determined it was not timely. Based on my understanding of the law, I think on its face, it's timely. And I believe it's for that basis that the district court's order should be overruled, and this matter should be set back on the district court's calendar for hearing. Another item, if the court for some reason determines that I'm incorrect on that, and I think that's supported by good law, then we get into the NAPLA analysis. And I'll just walk through that, even though I don't think we need to go there, but I'll walk through that because we spent
a considerable moment. Leave the statutory, the statute of limitations under the statute, okay, the limitations period under the statute. I don't think that you describe what you just laid out now in your brief. So we'll just put that, we'll look at that. And so I'm just like, just leave that aside for a moment and assume, let's assume for a moment that the 2 years dated from the date of final judgment on October 16th after the our Supreme Court denied review. We'll just assume that for a moment. Still, you need to, and so that the 2 years, so that it would not be within the 2 years you're filing, okay? If we assume that for a moment for purposes of argument. What is
it? I can assume that, Your Honor. I'm happy
okay.
to do that.
So in order still to invoke the interest of justice exception, the appellant has to allege that an injustice occurred that prevented him from filing a timely petition within the 2 years after within that 2 year time period after the final judgment. What injustice occurred that prevented the appellant from timely filing?
Well, I think just the way the case developed, I think, is the best way to look at this. And so what you have here is you have two companion cases. You've got the underlying drug conviction sales case, which my client is presently incarcerated on, and then you have the pending homicide matter. And on the pending homicide matter, where there's allegations of an overdose that he provided contraband to an individual that ultimately passed on, that's where this challenge was made to the search warrant application.
Right, I appreciate that, but I'm just wondering how that you achieved success with different lawyers on a different case on a suppression motion, how that prevented him from making his claims here in a timely way under the limitations period.
Well, I mean, I think the question should be phrased in a way where does the law support him bringing his petition when he did? And I think it did the way I answered the question when we talked about it the first time. And now when we look at it the second way, he has to come under one of the two exceptions. So he has to come in under whether fairness so requires, and the petitioner did not deliberately and inexcusably fail to raise the issue on direct appeal. And so the way I see this case, he didn't know that he
NAFLA.
Had.
I think that's NAFLA you're talking about.
It is
not.
NAFLA.
Oh, okay.
I
was still on a statute of limitations period, but that's okay.
Okay, so, yeah, the way, I mean, he didn't really know that he had this issue, that this issue was relevant for a post-conviction relief petition until he received the order in January of 2020. And once he received the order in January of 2020 saying that the evidence was suppressed on the companion case, it's my view then that he had 2 years to act within that time period to bring this case, to bring this issue forward to the court's attention. And he did that. And I think justice requires that this court would hear that case on the merits. We're not talking about some benign search warrant. We're talking about a search warrant that really dug into his life in a way that is most introspective by examining a person's phone. In this case, you had two phones that were examined. It is something that was certainly consequential as it related to the underlying conviction. He acted deliberate. He had to hire a lawyer. We were going through this whole COVID period of time. He had a new lawyer, which was me on it. We bring a petition within 2 years of after we get Judge Chase's order. And the issue that he brought forward is a very, very significant issue in relation to the search warrant. Otherwise, I'll stand on what's in my brief. I don't have a lot of other comments unless there's questions.
I do have questions. Can you give me more about why if we get to Strickland, because, you know, not NAFLA barred, not time barred, and we get to Strickland, explain to me the prejudice, what the evidence that came in as a result of the search warrant in this case and how it actually would have been a different outcome but for the evidence. Describe to me the evidence that came in based on a failure, based on non-suppression, and how it affected this case.
So a couple of things. Number one, there wasn't an objection made to the data of the phone being brought before the jury. There wasn't an objection from trial counsel. The issue wasn't brought up on direct appeal. At the trial setting, the evidence that came in from the phone, I didn't try that case. Based on my understanding of that evidence that came in from the phone, it provided evidentiary support for the prosecution as it related to the various tracking and movements of the defendant. It also provided information connecting the relative CIs to the defendant. Not only did you have the confidential informant's testimony, you had law enforcement testimony, but then you had this connection between all of that in a very confirming matter with the telephone information coming in. So we've got GPS surveillance. We've got evidence of communication with the CI. You also had photographs and the like that came in associated with the phone, all of which the court determined on the companion case was not proper. And in handling drug cases through the years, this court hears so many appeals on drug cases. Really, the signature in a drug case is found of a drug dealer is found on the individual's telephone. We track all of the movements. You have photos, you have communications, you have all of these things that appear on the telephone. And so the way I view the transcript of the case, it was the number one piece of evidence that brought the entire prosecution's case together because
So tell me about the GPS tracking. When was that tracked? Because I think they got this search warrant after there had been like five buys, right? Controlled buys. And then there was an actual trip to Illinois and then a return. Then I think the search warrant happens and they get the phone. So tell me how that phone resulted in GPS surveillance. How the fruits of that search resulted in GPS surveillance.
Well, I think when they got the search warrant and they were able to extract the information from the phone, they were able to confirm. They were surveilling him during the time. I acknowledge that. And the Rockfield, Illinois trip, that was a part of this process. But what they did is once they got the information from the phone, they were able to confirm all of that.
To see where that the phone had, in fact, traveled with him. Yeah. And the informant to Illinois and returned.
And there was a lot of they had that whole ping analysis, right? Where they track all the were pinged at the various towers. I don't know how to explain that very well right now, but that's what they extracted from that phone. And there was other evidence, and I think counsel argues in the counsel's brief that there's kind of a harmless error analysis that the court should employ. But what happens in these drug cases is because you have these CIs who have information, they have their own background that's relevant to determine their credibility. And what prosecutors do and what law enforcement do is they take these objective indicators, if you will, such as a phone, to support the story of the CI and the law enforcement generally. And it's just the glue that brings that case together. And that's what happened here. And that jury should not have had this evidence presented to it, as we now know later. I don't know if he would have been convicted. We don't know that. But when you put this evidence in front of a jury that ties everything together in the way the prosecution wants, that's not a fair trial for this defendant. And we know now that warrant was defective. So just in short, unless there's other questions, but in short, I think we're right on the timing. I don't know where we could be wrong. That seems to be black letter law to me, this additional 90 days. If we add that, we're there. If we don't add that, we're having this different analysis and the court has to make a determination, whether or not it's fair for an individual such as this to be tried and convicted on evidence that we know should not have been put before the jury. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. For the first time now in oral argument, counsel raises a new argument, citing what he calls black letter law, that the statute of limitations here is somehow expanded by an additional 90 days. And cites a couple cases that I could not find in his brief, nor any reference to these statutes. So I'm, a little bit hamstrung in responding to that, but I just simply fall back on the plain language of the statute here, which is what was argued in the brief and what we argued, which I think is unambiguous, starting this 2-year time period. It was certainly not addressed to in the post-conviction proceeding, and it was... So I think I stand on the statute as it is, that it's a 2-year limit from the entry of judgment of conviction or sentence or an appellate court's disposition of the petitioner's direct appeal, which I think is the applicable here. So I'll rest on that. Maybe following up, I think maybe counsel and I have a different reading of the record here, and maybe I missed it.
Before we get to this, and I do want to get to that once we get into the Strickland analysis. So, I mean, you're obviously, just to sum up, you still obviously are arguing that it's time barred under the statute. Secondly, the NAFLA, I just wanted to address that. Why would there be a NAFLA bar to ineffective assistance of appellate counsel?
At the time of trial in this case, Antonio Beasley knew that the police had seized his phones, that a warrant had been executed to extract data from them. And if his attorneys wanted to challenge that, they could have. But for, I think, obvious reasons, they did not do so because there was no relevant evidence extracted from the phone that the state offered at trial.
But what about appellate counsel? Why is the appellate counsel claim NAFLA barred when one would not have had an earlier opportunity than this motion to challenge your appellate counsel's?
Well, what's really being led, as we said in our brief, when you're viewing the actions of appellate counsel with respect to, we first look to the underlying trial counsel. That what's being claimed here is the trial counsel.
Mr. Haas, were either ineffective assistance of counsel claims, both trial court and appellate court, were they even considered or ruled on by the district court? I don't know that we as an appellate court should be dealing with that issue. Can you tell me if there was a resolution?
No. The post-conviction court here decision ruled only on the timeliness. And it is that decision that's been brought on appeal. The post-conviction court did not rule on those other issues.
Although you raised it.
I addressed them in my brief, yes.
I mean, to the district court. And you're presenting it here. Yes, as an alternative basis to affirm if we were to find it timely, that we it's still not worth. Okay, let's turn to where I think you were headed to the record and more the merits review of the under the Strickland analysis. And specifically, I think, well, you could do both prongs, or I don't know if you wanted to start with the prejudice prong.
Well, I think the prejudice prong actually not only does it support the Strickland argument, but also plays into this notion of, what should they have, whether it was reasonable or not, and whether it would have affected. I know it's an expansive trial, and maybe I missed it, but I didn't see anything about GPS tracking in this trial. Certainly wasn't argued in the closing. And before the argument today, I went back and reread the state's closing argument just to make sure there was none of that sort of thing in there. I sure didn't see it. Again, the warrant was executed after he was arrested. They weren't tracking with GPS via the phone. Now, maybe, I don't know, maybe there was some tracking device planted on his phone. Not his phone, but his car, for example.
Understood, though, is that Mr. Bergara was saying, well, it was actually, I mean, it was location data evidence, that they used that retrospectively to follow the location of the phone, and that was corroborating evidence, I guess, or important evidence to prove that it was actually of what happened.
The appellant cites none of that in his brief and provides no citation to the record of such evidence being admitted. I didn't see it. Now, maybe I missed it. Again, I'm, I guess, proving something that doesn't exist. The only evidence that may have come from the phone extraction was the phone number relating to one of the phones that corresponded with the phone number that the CRI was using to communicate with Mr. Beasley to set up the controlled buys. That's the only evidence I saw that the state offered at trial. Now, whether they may have retroactively been able to do that, and whether or not that may have assisted them in saying, yep, we've got the right guy, I don't know if that was the case, but it wasn't. That's beyond the scope of this record. I don't see any of it in the transcripts. There were no exhibits.
So speak to the question of the phone number being extracted and its use at trial, and why, in your view, that the absence of that evidence would not have changed the outcome.
Well, I talked about this confidential, reliable informant in my brief. He was a young man from Rochester that went to our local schools. He became addicted to opiates from a wisdom tooth thing and became addicted to heroin. He bought heroin from Mr. Beasley on a daily basis for a couple of years. He knew Mr. Beasley. And so these controlled buys are not some sort of thing where we're dealing with the drug dealer only through electronic means and we're trying to identify the drug dealer in that fashion. This was direct evidence by a sworn witness who said, that's my drug dealer. I've dealt with him for years. That's the guy. And it's not just that. These controlled buys were under surveillance. And
the CRA testified at the trial,
yes,
as well as the police officers.
Yes,
about that the controlled buys.
Yes, of course. And of course, the controlled buys were monitored by police officers who observed this. But even if we suppress the evidence from those controlled buys, again, that phone number relates only to the controlled buys, which garnered, you know, around 10 grams or so of heroin from those buys. But independent of this phone number, the CRI accompanied Mr. Beasley to Rockford, Illinois, and testified to that, accompanied him back in the same car where Mr. Beasley was arrested in Olmsted County in that car, and there was 197 grams of heroin in the car. So even if Mr. Beasley's trial counsel had raised this below and succeeded in suppressing any data extracted from the phone, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. You could have excised those controlled buys, or at least the evidence, at least the heroin procured from them, and still would have a gracious plenty of heroin to meet the statutory thresholds. So look, his trial counsel knew that the phones had been seized and searched, and they made a strategic decision not to challenge it because it wouldn't have made a difference. And we don't generally second guess strategic decisions by trial counsel at the appellate level. And the appellate counsel's review of the case hinges off of that and can apply the same analysis. I mean, how would it have made a difference? And so when we apply NAFLA, we look at, you know, whether this claim was known or should have been known at the time, and it was. I disagree that this is a new and novel ruling of law. I think Judge Chase's expansive omnibus ruling in the collateral case dealing with the third degree homicide underscores the fact that while this may be an evolving and emerging area of law as, you know, technology interfaces with our lives, there's numerous cases where, you know, attorneys have challenged search warrants based on the notion that they are overly broad and lack particularity. I cite a couple of unpublished cases in my brief from, I think, 2015 and 2016, just simply to say they're out there. This is not new or novel. Now, maybe at the time they didn't think they would prevail on it, and maybe they were surprised at the outcome in that case, but that's not to say that they shouldn't have been aware of this legal issue.
Right. I guess the question for me, again, getting back to the appellate counsel on NAFLA, because you're back in the NAFLA land, is I understand, of course, that the failure of appellate counsel, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim about the appellate counsel sort of bootstraps in what happened at trial counsel. But there are myriad cases, it seems to me, where the appellate counsel at the next available opportunity to raise that ineffective assistance of appellate counsel gets considered. It's not NAFLA barred, even though, and maybe you have some authority that say that appellate counsel claims are NAFLA barred if they rely on ineffective assistance of trial counsel, but I guess I don't know what case that is. So if you have a case that we could look at that says, yep, that's NAFLA barred too, that would be helpful.
Well.
And if there's not one off the top of your head, that's okay, but sure.
Well,
that's
my
question.
What I did cite is, let me pull it up here. It says, this is Wright v. State, and it said it on page 12 of my brief, and it says, and I quote, when an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims is based on appellate counsel's failure to raise an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, which is what is alleged here, the petitioner must first show that trial counsel was ineffective. So
yes,
in order for him to say that my appellate counsel was ineffective because they didn't attack the behavior of my trial counsel, I mean, logically, you first have to show that the trial counsel failed. And that's my fundamental argument here, that these attorneys were by no means ineffective based on their strategic decision not to challenge that search warrant, because there was no relevant evidence extracted from the phone that was relevant in this case. And the only thing that, the only conceivable poisonous fruit from that tree is this phone number that came in during Officer Schlag's testimony. But again, that at best just corroborated the CI who said, well, yeah, I call him on this phone number. But, and of course, there was no objection to that testimony either, because it frankly just wasn't I don't know if it was in dispute. And again, based on the second Strickland prong, it was such a de minimis piece of evidence that, you know, the state never mentioned it in its opening statement. The state mentioned nothing in its opening statement from the phone. The state mentioned nothing about the phone or anything from it in its closing statements. And I know generally there is a lot of evidence that can be gleaned from phones and you can do various things. That's not this case. And forgive me if I misstate the record, I did not see any evidence in this case that came from that phone extraction. And I think the trial counsel saw the same thing, and there was no point in challenging it because it wouldn't have mattered. And so, yes, the challenge to the appellate counsel's ineffectiveness is inextricably tied to that of the trial counsel. I guess I've stated about as plainly as I can, unless the panel has any further questions for me. I would simply ask the court to affirm the decision of the post-conviction court and dismiss the appeal.
Your Honor, you're muted, I think.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. McGraw. We'll get the clock set up and then you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead.
Thank you. So, I think part of the challenge here, and counsel and I are trying to recall the transcript probably the best way we can, and I know neither one of us are trying to mislead or overstate or even understate the transcript, but I think we're kind of limited in that regard because the court didn't put it on for a hearing. So what typically happens in these cases, in my experience, is if there's a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel made, as long as it's timely, which is here, the court determined it wasn't, and we've discussed that, but the court wants to talk, this reviewing court wants to talk about, you know, what was the exposure of that tainted evidence, if you will, if it was tainted. And it's hard for us to do because we didn't have a hearing. Counsel talks about—
I don't understand that. Why would an evidentiary hearing make it easier to find record sites for us of what happened at the trial?
Yeah, in part because, you know, Your Honor, counsel is claiming that the trial counsel made a strategic decision not to object to the information from the phone coming in. Well, we don't know that until we take trial counsel's testimony. And that's why on these type of cases where there's allegations made regarding ineffective assistance of counsel, we really don't get to the bottom of that until we can have that prior lawyer placed under oath and ask questions about why there weren't objections made to this evidence coming in.
So, Mr. McGraw, are we in a position where we can infer that the district court ruled not in your client's favor? Because we don't have any district court order to review. And I struggle with that because I know you want it done and we want to be efficient, but there's no order for us to review on ineffective assistance of counsel. So can we infer that a decision was made?
I mean, I think the order speaks for itself. And I think what Judge Chase did is he analyzed the case specifically relative to the timing of the petition, and he didn't go beyond that. And so we're all kind of speculating on what the merits look like, but he focused entirely on the timing of it. And I think for this court, the best way to give us guidance on how to address this issue going forward is to resolve the timing issue. And if the timing issue is resolved in my client's favor, then I think the district court has to grant a hearing, and then we can get into.
I'm confused a little bit about that. I mean, the arguments were made below on Strickland as well, right? But the district court didn't reach them because it decided it on timing.
Correct.
But Strickland is, we could give de novo review. If we could look at the record of the trial and determine that there was not prejudice under prong two, you don't need an evidentiary hearing to determine that. You don't need a witness to testify as to what happened at trial. The record tells us what happened at trial.
Correct. And the district court didn't do that, though. This court could. This court could do that. And I think the two attorneys here are probably doing the best we can to not overstate or understate the record. But I just don't have that clarity to probably point you in those directions based upon the trial transcript at this point. And I know the basis of our brief, and counsel touches it on his brief, but we primarily focused on the timing of the issues, and we didn't really get into the effect of the evidence coming forward. I still think the best way to deal with that would be, once this court resolves the timing, we go back to the district court on the ineffective assistance of counsel petition, and then we have an opportunity to fully explore that and then get a full record. And then this court, if it comes back up, would have an opportunity to review it on a more fulsome record. So I'd ask that we vacate the prior order. The court, I think, simply had it wrong on the timing. I think the argument that I started out with today, talking about that additional 90 days, I think that's black letter law, if you will. And I would ask that this matter be placed back on the court's calendar for further hearing at the district court level. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. The case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. Have a good day.
Thanks.